I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Jennifer Loudon joins me now. The best-selling author has a new book out, Why Bother? Discover the Desire for What's Next. I'll ask her about the book and how useful it could be in this unprecedented time of COVID-19. The book is about how to overcome hell in one's life and how self-care can guide one to a better future. I ask her about how one can be more optimistic despite the challenges in life and circumstance. I also ask her about identity, anger, self-discovery, routines, and what enoughness is. Jennifer Loudon's six previous books include the bestsellers The Woman's Comfort Book and The Life Organizer. Her website is at jenniferloudon.com. This new book is published by Page Two. She joined me from Boulder, Colorado. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Jennifer Loudon. Ms. Loudon, good morning.
Oh, good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for joining us. So one would assume that your book is for a certain audience or a certain age demographic, but, I mean, after I was reading it, I got a sense that, you know, we all face existential crises.
Yes, we do.
So, I mean, it is for everyone, isn't it?
Yeah, I started off with three women in mind who I knew. One was just different friends and clients. But as the book emerged, and, you know, you go back and you do rewrites, and I started talking about the book to other people, they would say, but my 20-year-old granddaughter needs that. Or, you know, I just got a text earlier today, a friend whose child is about to graduate from college, as one of my children is too, uh-huh. And faced with this pandemic, and how am I going to get a job? And she said, I'm going to get him to read it. So I do think existential crisis is the human condition.
Yeah, and this is a unique time, and a lot of us have some time on our hands. It affords us, I guess, the right time to reassess one's life, doesn't it?
I think it can. We just have to be careful because some of us are really triggered or traumatized or, you know, there's just so much in the news, and everyone now knows someone who's being affected,
right.
Or many people who are being affected. So if we feel strong enough and stable enough to go, hey, what changes might I want to make? I think fantastic. And if we don't, if we're like, okay, I'm in survival mode, as a friend of mine said, my goal is to get out of here alive.
Yeah, exactly. What do you say to people who might come up to you, Jennifer, and say that what's the use about being optimistic? Why bother being optimistic even? What do you tell them?
Yeah, I think cynicism is a way that we protect ourselves. It's a way that we keep ourselves from asking the hard questions about our lives, and it's a way that we actually hide from disappointment. I mean, we hide from the existential crises, if you want, that are here to help us grow. Mm. And we basically, when we're cynical and we say, why bother to be optimistic? Why bother to care again? Why bother to fall in love again or learn to play the fiddle or whatever it is, try for a new job? We're saying, I give up on life. This is all I'll ever have. And when you really step back and think about that, I mean, I bet you can feel that I can feel it like a weight in my stomach. Like I just ate too many pancakes, right?
Yeah.
It's just, wow, how awful is that? But we do it because we don't think we can bear more disappointment, more heartbreak, more trying and not having it go the way we want. And sign me up. I've been there. But when I look back on my life, those are the regrets I have, not the failures from trying, but the fact that I gave up and stopped trying, that I stopped daring, that I stopped desiring. Because how can we do that to present-day self? We're saying present-day self doesn't get a life, doesn't get a chance, because we don't like what happened in the past. And that just seems so heartbreakingly unnecessary to me and not true.
So a lot of people worry about, trying is too hard, and so why bother getting off their duff and doing anything? Some people might think they're too old or that it's too late for them. How do you advise those people to take action now?
Yeah, I think the first thing we have to do, and I have these six stages in the book to lead people through this idea of finding that energy again. And the first thing that I want to say is when we're saying it's too late, it's too old, I'm too old, there's no point, we are telling ourselves that we already know the answer to the question, why bother? We've completely cut off any sense of curiosity or hope. And I'm sure if we sat down with a friend or a child or a colleague and they were, and we've heard other people doing this, almost always we're like, you got to be kidding me. Why wouldn't there be more for you? It will look different than the past, but why wouldn't there be something that can be in its own way fulfilling, interesting, delicious, pleasurable? How can you know? So the first thing I say to people is the why bother question, the why bother process, if you will, it's not about getting an answer. It's about finding that joy again, that meaning, that flow, that connection. You've got to give yourself time to do that. And what we do instead is cut it all off and say, I already know the answer, and it's no. So that's the first thing we have to do is just begin to question that maybe we don't know the answer to. We're too old. There's no point. We're too late. We're asking ourselves the question, but we're not really asking the question. So try to start asking, I wonder if I wasn't too old, if it wasn't too late. And See if you can just open the door a teeny bit. That's all you need is a teeny bit.
The other problem that comes up, Jennifer, is if one makes a change, we assume a great change especially, that would change one's identity. And some are reticent to do anything because their identity is too much a part of themselves.
I can so relate. I have been there so many times, and I'm sure I'll be there again. And that's the way the human mind and brain works. It's very natural. But one of the things I'd like to say to people is, can you look back in times in your life that you were able to let go of an identity, a way of seeing yourself? You know, I'm thinking of people that I've worked with who identified very strongly with being a successful business person, and then they retired, or their business was sold, or they decided to sell their business, and that big, huge, oh my God, this empty space. And our human brains freak out with uncertainty. This is why the pandemic, for one reason, is so hard for us. Mm-hmm. We don't like uncertainty. But try to frame it, everybody. Instead of thinking of, I'm afraid of change, I can't give up my identity, what if you're afraid of being undefended and you can learn ways to feel defended even as you begin to play around with your identity, with change, with new possibilities? So it's a different way to frame it, if that makes a little bit of sense.
Right. And the other thing that a great lesson in the book is it's one thing to, you know, be compassionate to other people, which is I guess what we expect everybody to be. But we often forget to be compassionate to ourselves. And that's very important in terms of self-care and self-preservation even, right?
Absolutely. If there's one thing that kept me stuck in my longest and most awful why bother time, way past the point where I needed to still be there, it was being cruel to myself. And we have to realize that our brains default to being hard on ourselves. And one theory is it helped us stay part of the tribe. It helped us stay where we would be safer with other human creatures. And so we default to being really hard on ourselves, being really judgmental. We never would speak to other people the way that we speak to ourselves, except perhaps, you know, a few people politics.
Right, exactly.
But we have to learn to practice that being kind to ourselves, that giving ourselves a break, that seeing the best, that we do have these really good, kind hearts, or we will stay stuck in a dead, apathetic, despairing place. Absolutely. If there's one thing to change, it's how we speak to ourselves and think about ourselves.
Another great lesson in the book is this idea of pacing oneself. I mean, let's say some of us are self-isolating or spending time alone. There are all these expectations online, especially, that we have to use this time like everybody else and bake or garden or
write a novel.
Right, exactly, yeah. So what do you recommend in terms of how to deal with the expectations? You just spoke about the expectations we have on ourselves, but the expectations that others may have on us.
Yeah, it's so interesting. I went on my Facebook page today and asked people if they had any hobby or productivity shame, right? Mm. I should be organizing my photos, learning Japanese, and I got so many interesting replies, and some of them were things like, if I don't do it now, I'll never do it. So they're putting a lot of pressure on themselves. Some people are saying that it doesn't feel like what they do matters when other people are on the front line saving people's lives. Yeah. Some people are saying it's their Midwestern roots, you know, that they learn that every moment should be filled with productivity. So I think there's a lot of collective and personal reasons why we might be extra hard on ourselves to be really use this time wisely. And the big thing that we're forgetting is that by being hard on ourselves or pushing ourselves during this time, we're completely overlooking the fact that we are metabolizing emotionally this incredible amount of uncertainty and sorrow, and that takes up cognitive resources. That's why we're so exhausted, that we can't focus, that we're clicking around, that we're wandering around the house doing a little bit of this and then leaving it half undone. It's not that you're losing your mind or that you're, you know, procrastinating. It's that you're realizing that the entire globe is experiencing something. So if anything, this time, I feel, is a time that we need to way lower our standards of what we expect of ourselves.
You write in the book, it's a helpful book for its readers, but it's also a personal book in that you talk about situations that you've encountered in your life. And I found particularly interesting the part of the book where you talk about anger and how we need to understand how angry we are.
Because if you think about it, if we're denying where our anger is, or we're letting it just turn into endless outrage that's going to burn us out, we're not actually sitting down to ask ourselves the hard questions of, what do I want to take action on in my life, in the body, in the politics, the world of politics, the world of my community? You know, when we overlook the things that anger us, we're basically telling ourselves what you feel and what you notice and what you care about doesn't really matter. And that is a profound way to fall into why bother, right? Well, I don't deserve to be angry about that, or I'm too small. I couldn't do anything about that. That, again, history proves you wrong. History is made up of billions of people saying, I'm going to take this one little action. I care about this. I'm going to let myself care about this. I'm going to let myself be angry, and I'm going to metabolize that anger. I'm going to use it. I'm not just going to let it eat me alive.
A lot of what you've talked about in our chat now and from what I've read of the book makes a lot of sense to a lot of people. I mean, it's stuff that we essentially know or have
For sure.
known, but we've lost sight of, haven't we? We've forgotten some of these important lessons.
Yeah, I had somebody who interviewed me yesterday say, this feels like a book that should already have been written. And I thought, yeah, right? It's like the book that you're like, okay, yeah. But somehow this time, this moment, the way I put it together, people can go, oh, yeah. Because I think that's really what I do in life, is remind people of what they already know and help them, you know, make a distinction that's more clear so they can really start acting on it.
Yeah, we tend to forget a lot that's wise, a lot that we need to remember.
Well, that's because of the way our brains are built, right? We
sure.
are basically human enigmas walking around thinking we understand ourselves.
Yeah, that goes into another point you make near the end of the book about the power and the danger of a routine. I don't usually tape interviews this early in the morning, but the first date and time that your publicist gave me, I said, you know what, I'll get up early that day. And switch up my routine, and I mean, the possibilities that I have for the rest of my day are endless at this point.
Right. Yeah. So what I find is that, you know, especially in the last 10 years, we've seen a lot of really interesting books and research into habits and how powerful it can be to work on a really small habit that can begin to change your whole day, your whole life. Like, for instance, for me, a habit that I was really 100% good at before the pandemic was I never had my phone in the bedroom because I never wanted to end the day looking at the phone because it disturbs my sleep, and I never want to begin the day looking at my phone. But then the pandemic started, and I started wanting to obsessively read the news. I wanted to make sure I knew that the kids were okay,
sure.
things that I never would do before. That's not turned out to be a good habit change, so I need to go back. But the point I make in the book is sometimes we fall in love with our habits and routines and they become very deadening, right? Mm. I call it kind of assume the position, you know, I'm going to sit down. This is the way I have to have my morning, or I'm going to be okay. That can be a place that we can play to bring life and curiosity into our day and our life.
Another great lesson in the book, near the end of the book, is the gift of settling down, the grace of inner stillness, which is a great turn of phrase, I must say.
Oh yeah, I love that one too.
we've got the time to be still nowadays, but because we're worried, we don't take the chance to do that. And even without the pandemic. Making the time to just be still, to be quiet. I mean, it's incredibly useful, isn't it?
It's essential. Mm-hmm. It's essential. We won't, without the very, very biological level of stopping the distractions, stopping the text going off, the news alerts on your phone or your computer. I mean, I look at some of my friends and colleagues, and I'm like, I don't know how you ever have a complete thought time. But when we come to how do we bother, what do we care about, what do we want to let go of, and what do we want to focus on, how the heck are we going to know if we don't have any time to be with ourselves, to fall into a deep feeling of being? I got a message earlier from a neighbor in my, I call it my old life. I used to live in the Pacific Northwest. I live in Colorado now. Mm-hmm. And she said that she had saved up money. She got her daughter launched. And for the first time in her life, she was going to take a sabbatical from being productive and successful. She didn't know what to do with herself. She said it was the hardest thing she had ever done. And it wasn't until the pandemic, where she kind of felt like everybody was with her in it, that she could really begin to settle down. So it's hard. I'm not saying it's easy, but we need it.
And an easy way to start, or a simple way to start, if you will, is if you're busy Monday to Friday, and you're sleep deprived, as I often am, I found it useful just to book the time in my calendar for a nap on the weekend.
Oh gosh, I love a nap. My favorite thing to do on the weekends, there's an idea in the book called the desire retreat. And it's very simple. You set aside some very clear time, mm-hmm. and you only do exactly what you want. And I do that most every Saturday. I usually do a long run, and that kind of calms my body, mind down, gets rid of the noise. And then I'm just like, what do I want to do all afternoon? And it almost always involves a nap.
Yeah. One of the compelling things about the book is effective, I should say, is when you talk about your story, because you've gone through it all, if you will, and it makes the lessons that you're imparting on the reader relatable when you relate them to experiences in your own life. Does telling your story, does that also benefit you, say?
It benefited me hugely. This book arose out of the ashes of 4 years and 500 pages of trying to write a memoir, like a straight memoir, a mm-hmm. narrative memoir that failed completely as a book. But that writing those 500 pages changed me utterly, and it gave me the clarity to look back at my life and really realize how I had come to bother again, and how so many times in my life I had interrupted the process. So without that, I never would have changed as much as I have, and I never would have been able to write this book. I think writing our stories for ourselves, for some people who like words, I mean, some of us don't, and that's mm-hmm. totally fine. There's lots of ways to do this, can be so helpful.
And that's the interesting thing. It started out as a memoir, and it ended up as a different sort of book.
Yeah, so helpful, really.
Yeah. That the other thing I just want to touch on before I let you go is this idea of enoughness. How do you explain that to people?
Well, if we don't declare what is enough for us in very practical ways, it is very difficult for us to ever be satisfied. We live in a culture that is always telling us that if we could just change in this way or that way, then we would finally be satisfied. And it becomes this, it's like, it's always two steps down the road, a mile ahead of us. When I get there, then. Mm-hmm. And that by itself can cause us to ask why bother, because we never feel like enough. We never feel satisfaction. So I try to give you a really simple 4-part process to begin to look at some of the ways you're doing that in your life. Maybe it's around your health or your communication and your intimate relationship, and begin to name what would be enough for you, not for someone else. And it's been a practice I've been teaching people for many years, and it's really profound. It's really simple, and it's really profound.
It's I've jumped all over the place because there's a number of things I wanted to touch upon in the book. I appreciate your time today. This is I'm sure people listening to this will find this a useful book. Congratulations on it. Good luck with it.
Thank you so much. Thanks so much for this conversation. It was wonderful.
The book is called Why Bother? Discover the Desire for What's Next. It is published by Page 2. JenniferLoudon.com is the website for more, incidentally. Jennifer Loudon joined me on the line from Boulder, Colorado. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Plata.